From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The UN Security Council approved Wednesday what U.S. Ambassador Samantha Power called the toughest sanctions regime in two decades on the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or DPRK, known in the West as North Korea. The resolution, which was adopted unanimously by all 15 members, imposed additional economic sanctions in response to the DPRK's recent nuclear and ballistic weapons tests. In January, Pyongyang said it had tested a hydrogen bomb in its fourth of those tests. Matthew Wells reports.
The North Korean government would rather grow its nuclear weapons program than grow its own children.
The United States ambassador to the UN, Samantha Power, making clear what she views as the perverse reality of the DPRK's nuclear ambitions in defiance of international law and at the expense of its own people. She said that given the regime's continuing nuclear proliferation and pursuit of long-range missile technology, the Security Council had no choice but to act. Stressing that the resolution had won the backing of 50 UN member states, she outlined the ways in which relentless pressure would now be brought to bear on North Korea's regime. All cargo going in and out of the country will now be inspected. Many key exports like coal, iron and gold will now be limited or banned. And the country will no longer be supplied with aviation fuel. She said all but small arms sales would now be prohibited. But despite the salvo of new sanctions, she added that they were aimed at the rulers of the DPRK, not the ruled. Crucially, China lent its support to the resolution as the regional superpower with the ability to influence North Korea more than any other state. UN Ambassador Liu Jiyi said that sanctions were not an end in themselves, but a tool to prevent the dangerous nuclear proliferation facing the Korean Peninsula and all neighboring countries. He spoke through an interpreter.
Today's resolution should be a new starting point and a paving stone for a political settlement of the nuclear issue on the Korean Peninsula. History has demonstrated once again that dialogue and negotiations represent the only right way to address the nuclear issue on the peninsula. China urges the parties concerned to push forward negotiations.
And Russia's ambassador Vitaly Churkin said that although they had backed the unprecedentedly tough resolution, it was important not to let the whole North Korean state go into economic freefall. Again, his words were spoken by a translator.
The resolution we've adopted today should not be used to choke off the North Korean economy. In this connection, we are concerned about the hasty introduction, even before today's resolution was adopted, the introduction of unilateral sanctions against DPRK. All this could have very negative humanitarian consequences.
There was a path for DPRK's leadership to reverse the sanctions and return to the international community if it stepped away from its nuclear path, added Ambassador Churkin. Matthew Wells, United Nations.
China is the DPRK's largest trading partner. CCTV's Guangyang filed this report from Dandong, China, near the border with the DPRK, on the likely impact of the new sanctions on trade between Pyongyang and Beijing.
The draft resolution which imposed new sanctions on the DPRK have just been passed by the UN Security Council. Where I am is the riverfront facing the DPRK side, in what is one of the most prominent areas of Dandong, the largest city on the China-DPRK border. This area is home to several business entities run by the DPRK government and is within a few minutes' walk from the China-DPRK-friendly bridge which carries freight and people between the two countries. When it comes to the economic and the trade activities with the DPRK, Dandong has long been the bridgehead on the China-DPRK border. The cross-border trade here accounts for more than 80% of Sino-DPRK trade volume. There are more than 600 border trade enterprises in the city. China's major imports include coal, woven apparel, seafood and ginseng products. And exports include electrical equipment, heavy machineries, iron and steel. China is also a major supplier for DPRK's petroleum. In history, the DPRK has been under UN sanctions since 2006 because of its multiple nuclear tests and rocket launches. In addition to a UN arms embargo, Pyongyang is banned from importing and exporting nuclear and missile technology and is not allowed to import luxury goods. And if we look at the past statistics, figures show that DPRK's decision of nuclear testing doesn't always end up with a decline in bilateral trade. For instance, in 2006, China strongly denounced DPRK's first nuclear test, but trade between the two nations still topped $1.7 billion that year, which was 7% higher than the previous year. However, the following two tests in 2009 and 2013 had the gravest impact on bilateral trade. So how much will the new resolution affect the China-DPRK trade? We just have to wait and see. Guangyang CCTV, Dandong, Liaoning Province.
That Wednesday UN Security Council session took place as China's People's Political Consultative Conference, or PCC, opened its annual session. The PCC is a political advisory body in China consisting of delegates from a range of political parties and organizations, as well as independent members. The Communist Party of China and other political parties participate in the PCC, as well as an assortment of representatives from various sectors of society. The role that it plays in the Chinese government is somewhat analogous to an advisory legislative upper house, meeting and operating in tandem with the National People's Congress, the official legislature. There have been occasional proposals to formalize its role in China's constitution. Professor Zhao Zhangziu from China's University of International Business and Economics told CCTV that the country's economy was on the list of issues to be addressed at the conference.
Well, this year, I think, you know, first is the economic development and the growth. And since now we face the slowdown of the economy, so what we try to find the new engine for the development. And we know the way, that's the innovation and whatever. So the main is how we can achieve this and gradually. And so there, I suppose this the most people would like to do this. And the second would be the welfare. You know, since now we're coming to the new age, that's the aging people, that's the welfare to cover all the people, and so promote the society for the development. And actually, this is the 5 years, less than 5 years, that to achieve this the moderate community. So that's, I think, and also I suppose the people will also care about the anti-corruption as the new regulations and the rules that based on the rules. So that's been much more transparent and much clearer. That's for the first development.
U.S. media seemed of one voice following primary elections and/or caucuses in 12 states this past Tuesday, with almost unanimous projections of a Clinton-Trump presidential contest in November. But not everyone shared that position. Among the dissenters, Larry Hamm, who chairs the People's Organization for Progress based in Newark, New Jersey, he spoke with CPR's Bernard White via telephone Thursday.
I think we're facing a kind of political crisis, it seems, in the United States. If it's not a political crisis, then what we're facing is certainly, I think, a political sea change. That the whole character, maybe not in a fundamental way, but in a way significant enough for people to notice, to feel, we're facing a political sea change. Who would have guessed, you know, that this presidential election, you know, that the Ku Klux Klan would become an issue, you know? And, you know, who would have guessed that we would have had a guy running for president actually identifying himself as a democratic socialist, you know, and then even giving a whole speech on what his concept of socialism is, you know, who could have guessed these things? And I think it symbolizes a kind of evolution in politics, if not a kind of crisis, because now you have a situation in the Republican Party where the mainstream establishment Republican Party people are not in agreement with who is shaping up to be, who is Donald Trump shaping up to be the possible party nominee. And there's actually the possibility that the Republicans will go into a brokered convention, and that will be the first time that that has happened in more than 40 years in the United States. And on the Democratic Party side, here you have Hillary Clinton, whose husband at one point was one of the leaders of the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Council of the Democratic Party, which came into being, I believe, in the aftermath of the Jesse Jackson campaign and then the Dukakis campaign, who came into being with the stated purpose of shifting the Democratic Party to the left, to the right, because they felt that the party with Jackson and with Dukakis had shifted too far to the left.
And they wanted to make sure that they maintained power, because Jackson came in with some folks who were considered to be outsiders, and they did not want to relinquish power, so they set up a parallel government to organization to supersede what was developing.
Right, and think about it. They set up a parallel organization to the Democratic Party constitutional structure. I mean, it's one thing to talk about the party mainstream and the party establishment. That wasn't right enough for them. They had to set something else up to make sure, to ensure that, you know, it would shift back or at least stay in the hands of the conservative elements of the Democratic Party. And now the wife of one of those who was at the center of that effort, Bill Clinton, was at the center of that effort with one of our senators. People may not believe this, but I believe Bill Bradley, former U.S. senator, former basketball player, was also part of that effort. Now the wife of Bill Clinton is running and adopting some of the left, well, what one might call left populist rhetoric of her opponent, the guy that identifies himself as a socialist. So we see that this election, at least in its rhetoric and in its campaign efforts, is clearly not in the mold of previous elections of the last at least 60 years.
I think also what it reflects, or what we're looking at, is the consolidation of disaffection on both the Republicans as well as the Democrats.
Disaffection, yes.
Yeah, that people are really tired of the Democratic establishment.
That is the case. I agree with you 100%. I would just say this. I think that it's disaffection is characterized by a consolidation of disaffection in both parties. But I would have to say this, and I know some people might disagree. I would have to say white disaffection, because black people have been disaffected since we got here. But in terms of presidential elections, we have especially been disaffected since the election of Richard Nixon in 1968, I mean, especially disaffected. Remember, it was Nixon that put in place the Southern Strategy and began this whole shift, you know, where the white folks came out of the Democratic Party and went into the Republican Party in response to the civil rights and other civil rights movement and other social movements that were going on in the country in the 60s. In the changes that began in the 50s and going into through the 60s. But what we are seeing, I think, is one, a general disaffection, but I think also specifically it's the disaffection of whites that is really, I think, at the core of this. Mm-hmm. Because I think white people are now feeling the full effect of the economic crisis that this country has faced really since the end of the Clinton years. Whites are being faced with unemployment. They're also being faced with the foreclosure crisis. They're also being faced with seeing their status slip from being middle class to working class, and even some of them have slipped into poverty. That's some of the stuff they face on the economic side, and then on the cultural side, and this especially, I think, relates to those who are in on the right. They are disaffected, especially disaffected. They see the power shifting in America, whereas black people were totally locked out. I think the election of Barack Obama, the first black president of the United States, or the first black president in this contemporary period, they see that as emblematic of a perceived shift where the power is no longer in white hands, or firmly in white hands, and this Make America Great Again slogan that Trump has been touting is really a kind of dog whistle, you know, for the return of white, of blatant and open white power.
Right. So, the whole cry of "We want our country back." What do you mean?
That's right. You know, there's a South African word. There's an Afrikaner word, and I heard it once, and I used to hear it, you know, during the anti-apartheid period, when just before Nelson Mandela was released, or right after Mandela was released, and it was absolutely clear that the apartheid regime was going to fall, and they were talking about how that was affecting the white minority in South Africa, especially the Afrikaners. And how on the one hand there were some whites, you know, who were trying to prepare for the inevitable, but there were other whites, especially amongst the Afrikaners, who we used to say in cinema parlance, circling up the wagon. Mm-hmm. You remember we watched cowboy movies, and when the Indians would come, the wagon train master would say, "Circle up the wagon."
That's right.
And then they would fight the Indians from inside that circle. Well, there's actually an Afrikaner word for that circling of the wagons, because just like the cowboy stories are part of the American mythology, they have a similar mythology in South Africa, where the whites were fighting the indigenous people who were African. And there was an Afrikaner word for circling up the wagons. And they were talking about how the Afrikaners were mentally circling up their wagon, you know, because they felt that they were under siege and that they were going to lose not just their privilege in the case of South Africa, that they were going to lose the country. And I think we're seeing that similar, if not same phenomenon, maybe not as openly, but certainly existing nonetheless, that a lot of white people feel under siege, that the white privilege that they had and the kind of society that they lived in, they see it all changing before their eyes, and it's creating a kind of crisis mentality, you know, amongst them. And so a lot of them are rushing, you know, to people, to demagogues like Donald Trump, but not exclusively. I mean, what we say about Donald Trump, we would have to say about all the Republican candidates, because Trump has forced those who would like to, you know, talk in more moderate tones in order to gain votes and build a winning electoral strategy. He's forced them to unmask themselves, that their moderate tones were really just a mask for the same policy outcome. You know, so all of them were talking that talk, maybe not as strident as Trump, but certainly with regard to policy, you know, saying basically the same things policy-wise. And, you know, this is a kind of crisis in the a lot of regular working class white. And you hear, if you listen to the news, you hear certain terms that you don't hear too much in regular American media discourse. Like, I've heard the word class used more in this election than I've ever, and especially the word working class, you know, working class whites. You know, I hear that term so often now. And you didn't hear that kind of talk a lot. I mean, some people used it, but you didn't hear a lot of that in past elections. But now, almost every conversation is, well, this is how working class whites feel. Remember, they used to say blue collar, right?
Yeah.
But you notice they haven't been saying blue collar that much. They're saying working class whites. Hmm. You know, and another term I've heard, because they don't want to use the word white racism, I've heard some commentators that say Trump is attracting white nationalists. Have you heard that? I've heard that, not on the progressive radio stations, but even on some of these regular television news and talk programs. They're talking about white nationalists. Well, why don't they just say it? These are neo-Nazis and Klansmen. They're white racists, but they don't want to say white racists. Hmm. You know, they want to say white nationalists.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm like, well, define that. What is a white nationalist? Yeah. You know,
the other night I was watching a clip of Mussolini. And, you know, his histrionics, how he used to move in front of the microphone. And if you took Mussolini and put him in a suit, and put him right next to Donald Trump and, you know, turn the volume off, you see that these guys moved in quite similar ways.
Yes. In fact, Bernard, it is amazing to me that you just said this, because just the other day I was looking at these pictures that the New York Post puts on the front page of with Donald Trump and even the Daily News. I mean, there's some real colorful journalism. We used to learn about journalism in high school, and they talk about yellow journalism, but they always describe the tabloids with the yellow journalism. But there's more colors going on than yellow now. The news, the Daily News, and the New York Post, they're fighting it out. And on the front page of the Daily News, Trump, they actually had the word of the apocalypse. It wasn't yesterday. They had apocalypse over the picture with Donald Trump. And I guess that's supposed to symbolize that he represented the Antichrist to people, that this guy is the Antichrist. You know, but with regard to what you were saying about Mussolini, if you look at some of Donald Trump's photographs, he uses the same scowl. And I don't know if this is purposeful or if it's a coincidence. He uses the same kind of scowl on his face that Mussolini used. The popular pictures that we saw of Mussolini, he'd always have his arms, as they say, arms akimbo, with his both fists on his hips, you know. And he would never have, like, a smile. It would be a scowl, a frown. As people say, frown. And Trump uses that same kind of expression, and they do look alike. I mean, if you look at the pictures, they look frighteningly alike. Trump actually quoted Mussolini. He used this quote from Mussolini about being lions rather than lambs or something like that. And one of the reporters asked him about it, and he said that he didn't have any problem with the quote. He said it was still an interesting quote. Now, just think about that. This is a country that fought a war against Mussolini, against the fascists, against the Axis. And we can have a guy run for president, quote the leader of one of the countries we fought against. Our soldiers fought and died against in World War II, and nobody's calling him out on it. You know, nobody's calling out. And then the other thing I heard is that in the Klan, amongst the Klan and neo-Nazi groups that are supporting Trump, they are referring to him as our glorious leader. So this thing is getting really deep here. You know, and I guess this is why the Republicans, the Republican establishment, is now moving to try to block Trump from the nomination. But this is a really, I won't say dangerous yet, but it could become a very tense situation politically, at least on the Republican side, because it's clear that a lot of these establishment, see, they don't want to lose the whole thing. What they see in Trump is not someone who can win the presidency, but someone who could possibly destroy the Republican Party and cause them to lose everything that they have.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is that, yes, they want the White House, but they also want to maintain control of the House and the Senate. And if Trump, the more Trump goes forward, the more he unmasks the racist and reactionary elements that are now in the tent, well, have always been in the tent, but are now being exposed in being in the tent of the Republican Party, and that this could cause a lot of folks to vote against Republicans, not just for the White House, but also in the Congress and in the Senate.
Right. You know, they've suckled the sentiments for the last 8 years, and now they have a full-grown adult. It has become,
yes.
It has matured.
It's a Frankenstein monster. You know, it's a Frankenstein monster that's come back to destroy them, not destroy them in the you know, in the stricto sensu, but to cause them to lose their power. Remember, in the 30s, after the Great Depression and during the Roosevelt years, the Republican Party had hit a nadir. They didn't have a majority in the House. They didn't have a majority in the Senate. They didn't have the White House. In fact, they had a Democratic president who ran for an unprecedented fourth term. Unprecedented. He died. Roosevelt died in his fourth term. They don't want to return to a situation like that where they are totally out of power. And they see that the possible outcome of all of this could be the loss of the House and of the Senate. If you get a Democratic president in there, then there's a possibility of them losing the judiciary. Remember, mm-hmm. these Republican presidents over the last 40 years, Nixon, Reagan, George Bush the first, and George Bush the second, they packed the Supreme Court with conservative appointees. And that's how you got this reactionary Supreme Court we've had for the last 8 years. But now with the death of Scalia, there's a possibility that Obama will get to appoint one before he goes. And then if there's a Democratic president, they could appoint another two, possibly three. And that would ensure a liberal court for possibly several decades.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.